very lucky to be in that thing, and you know, and I appreciate my career, and I every day, you know, in work environments, I draw parallels to that as to how can you motivate other people, how can you get the best out of them, you know, how can you apply what I've learned in rugby to the professional environment.
You said last month on LinkedIn, I didn't just get back on track, I rebuilt a damn track. I really love that intention. Where are you today in terms of your comeback journey, and tell me how that started? Before we start this podcast, will you please like, follow, and subscribe to the Right Place podcast right here on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Rudolf and I would also love to connect with you on LinkedIn, so look us up there too. Thank you. Cheers. You're at the right place. Today I'm talking to Flip Vanhamava. He's the managing partner at Level 6 Consulting in France. He's a founding member of the Lacquer Network, like myself, and he's also Springbok number 818, where he played lock and had 36 appearances for the Springboks. Flip also played for the Cheetahs, the Griffins, the Bulls, and rounded off his career at Clermont in France, where he still lives today. Flip believes that routine is the biggest cheat code to success, whether in business, fitness, love, or mental health. The small increment improvements we make are what gets us ahead in the game, and we all know that life is a game, and this is the right place to unpack that with Flip. Welcome, Flip. This is a treat for me. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. It's great to be on you. I'm a big fan of your podcast and the insights you give. And well done on the Griffins. That's not a lot of people that pick up that I've played one match for the Griffins and almost gave up my rugby career there. I thought that was the end.
Yeah, you can't leave off the Griffins. Eh? They've got a special place in the rugby history of South Africa. Seems like the Pumas as well. The Griquas as well, these small teams that also have their space in the South African rugby landscape. And talking about rugby, Flip, we are a few days away from the first Springbok game of 2025. The Boks are taking on the Barbarians, Cape Town Stadium. Myself and a couple of other Lacquer Network members are going to meet up there for a drink before the game. And we're all 15 years away to the day when you made your Springbok debut against France on the 12th of June, 2010. What do you about that day? The Boks won the game, but it didn't quite go according to plan for you personally.
15 years, we are getting old now. It's quite a funny thing, John, is the day itself is, it's don't remember anything almost. Not to sound like a Chabal or raise awareness for mental illness, you know, after rugby, but it went past so fast, and I think the adrenaline that pumps, you know, you can't remember. I can't remember singing the anthem. I remember some funny things, you know, about checking if I have my boots in my bag about 7 times in the morning, because you just don't want to, you know, it felt like a dream being called up the whole week leading up to being called up for Springboks. I was on my yearly camping break in the middle of Namibia on a sand dune, getting calls from, back then it was Vaini Stradom and a guy called Charles Vessels, who's the logistics manager for the Springbok. And Charles Vessels left me a message. I didn't know I had a chance to be a Springbok. You sort of in and out of the squads, but I mean, you had Bucky's Puerta and Victor Matfield and Donny Rousseau and you name it. You can go, Andries Becker, you can go down the ranks. You know, there's so many locks ready to play for the Springboks. So I didn't expect it. I was on holiday and Charles Vessels left me a message and I sort of ignored it because I was like, I didn't know who Charles Vessels is. And he left me a random message in Namibia telling me you need to rock up and be in Cape Town on Monday to train with the Springboks. And I just thought, this must be a joke. And, you know, later the afternoon, we went for sundowners on top of a dune there near Saldanha Bay, a beautiful area of Namibia. And I saw, like, just messages coming through on my phone, like 14, 15 missed calls. And even Victor Matfield himself gave me a call. And then I realized, okay, something must be happening. Drove the 18 hours from Saldanha Bay to Cape Town on a Sunday evening, and that week was just a whirlwind. But yeah, as you said, got a yellow card in the game. Not that great.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. I mean, I actually watched the highlights of the game. PSP scored a try in the first minute of a Brian Abana takeaway. Gia Aplon was in top form. He got two tries. Arthur Steenkamp, the legend that he is, also got a try. And you a yellow card. And from the now infamous Bryce Lawrence, who was the referee in that game. But Flip, luckily you turned it around in your second game, which was a couple of weeks later. The Boxers, Italy in East London, came off the bench. You scored a try in your second test. And that must have made you feel a lot better about your Springbok career so far.
Yeah, it was a funny situation. You know, I obviously was new to the Springbok setup coming into a very experienced side. Big part of the side that played, they were champions in 2007, won the Tri Nations 2009. You know, Jake White was fired and Peter de Villiers became coach, and there was sort of an uncertainty about what's going on. If you hear some of the senior guys reflecting on that time, you know, they felt it was a horrible time. I felt that, you know, we were top of the world. But to tell you, you know, that 2010 French team was almost as good as they are now. You know, they went the Grand Slam in 2010, won the Grand Slam. They sent the big dogs over to play. You know, and they couldn't catch a ball that day on Newlands, luckily for us. And funny enough, you know, they had a lot of the Clermont Ferrand guys, the team that I played later for in that team. And later on, yeah, as you said, we were lucky we played Italy in Witbank, if I'm not mistaken, and was lucky to score a try with my old South African Springbok captain, John de Villiers, on my back. He pushed me over and we scored a try. It was a good moment.
And now, Flip, you come from rugby pedigree. Your dad, Flip, he played six games for the Springboks at prop, I think, in the 80s. Your brother, Francois, played for Western Province and then in France for a number of years. How did you support each other during your various rugby careers? I mean, obviously, you and your brother were young when your dad was playing, and then obviously your dad must have been so proud to produce two amazing rugby players. Like, tell me about that dynamic growing up in a rugby family and supporting each other.
Yeah, very interesting and a good question, because you get this perception, because my dad played, you know, we were fed rugby from, you know, very young age. I think John, South African and especially Afrikaans culture, you know, I'm probably as Afrikaans as they come, from that matter, you know, so you can't get around it. As we just play rugby, you know, you start, you know, I think you play rugby before you start walking even, you know, it's in our genes. And that said, is we also played all the other sports. We played cricket, we swam, tennis, water polo, you name it, we did it. That was just athletics. You know, we that was just the thing that everyone, all the kids were like that. You know, it's a little bit different than today, where everything is so focused and kids must be professional almost from a young age. And then that said, is like never one day that I feel the pressure of we have to perform because my dad played rugby or he pressured us. To play rugby, you know, my dad was always involved with rugby. And obviously as a young kid, that's, the best part, to go to a game or to, you know, be part of a training. And, you know, when I could start remembering, cause they played very few Springbok matches back then. I think in the 10 years he played, I only played six test matches. So, you know, for political reasons, the Springbok test matches, I unfortunately don't remember that much. I remember his twilight years when he was playing for Western Transvaal back then. You know, and he was a professor at the university. So it was just like a normal dad that tended to play for the Springboks on weekends. It was quite a good thing. Being with my brother is obviously, you know, my brother is bigger in size than me. Probably he was a very good player, and just because of the lay of the land, probably didn't get his opportunity to play for the Springboks, but very much could have as well. Came to France very early in his career and made a brilliant, you know, almost played 12 years in France. You know, won the European Cups and the top 14 as well with Racing Metro. So I think, you know, the wrestling sessions we had as young kids definitely helped us. And you know, the mutual support was always there, you know, to get to the matches and support each other through the highs and the lows. You know, there's a lot of lows in rugby as well that people miss, injuries, etc. And it was just about being there to support each other.
No, that's wonderful to hear, Flip, and it's wonderful to hear about the support and that you can be happy for other people's success and your brother's success. I'm sure he was happy for your success as well. Now, Flip, we could obviously unpack rugby for hours and hours. I mean, there's everyone's got an opinion. Everyone's got a favorite game or favorite moment. But I mean, you haven't been in the ecosystem of professional rugby, the ups and the downs, the injuries, the people you meet, the things that happen. Looking back now, how would you summarize your career and the path that it took in a few sentences?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. To summarize, I would say lucky. I was very lucky. I was a bit of a late starter, in normal terms, that I signed my first professional contract only at 24 with the Bulls. And then 6 months later, I was a Springbok. So, you know, very much being at the right place at the right time, and having these mentors around me, you know, being able to learn from a Victor Matfield and a Buckies and the coaches, you know, the Frans Ludekas and Johan van Graan. We're seeing how well he's doing. You know, he was a junior coach then when we were there. And to learn from these guys and be around these guys, PSPs, et cetera, and be an environment and being pulled up and being to the best, you know, being able to perform to the best that you could perform. So, you know, so that's very lucky to be in that thing. And, you know, and I appreciate my career and I every day, you know, in work environments, I draw parallels to that, as to how can you motivate other people? How can you get the best out of them? You know, how can you apply what I've learned in rugby, to the professional environment?
It's been quite interesting doing research on you and having a lot of your statistics. There's quite a few cool rugby websites out there who break down every game and whatever happened and who did what and why. Were you big on data during your rugby career? Were you into the stats, the carries, the meters made, things like that?
John, it's an interesting thing because we were sort of at the intersection of what, you know, the technical game that got today, you know, the money ball almost as they call it, is like, you know, we had coaches that said, you know, stats don't, you don't mind about stats, you know, it's about the scoreboard. But then at the same time, lucky to have played under a guy like Rassie Erasmus, who was, you know, even when he coached back in 2004, way ahead of his time in terms of that, in terms of the time you spent on the floor after a tackle to get back up on your feet and be usable, you know, as a player. He was able to measure that up until later to the Bulls, which was you know, quite scientific around the time you spend on your legs to be fresh, and then later on in the end of my career at Clermont-Ferrand, where we had like data scientists analyzing every step of the day. I was always quite interested in it. I was always quite interested just because I know the power and, you know, also because as a rugby player, you always try and find a reason why you are so tired. So, you know, I was always interested in it. But yeah, you know, we were more on the video analytics side of things. And, you know, we did a lot of homework on our position and on yourself and how to improve than we did on pure data. And it's just the way the game was back then.
That's very interesting, Flip. Now, fast forward to today, and you're the managing partner at Level 6 Consulting, and you're helping CEOs untangle their data, unlock clarity, navigate digital transformation, and build an AI strategy to get the most out of their data. What excites you about the work that you're doing currently?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting space we are in. We, you know, with AI coming in and with data architecture and most companies where the data transformation that we did 10, 15, 20 years ago are becoming legacy as well. And, you know, we have to keep evolving, and it's becoming a little bit of a headache, as we say, the tech stack in the commercial environment. So what do we do? And to help companies to actually be clear on what we can do with the data that we generate in the company. We're seeing very interesting things in different size companies, especially mid-cap companies that have this masses and masses of data, and just, you know, to pass that glass ceiling, you know, companies can use the data they already generate. So we're doing exciting work, and it's quite fun to not only the data, but to go further, you know, to see the people side of things. You know, that is changing as well. The type of human we need to recruit and the guy we need to have in a company these days are looking a little bit different than 20, 30 years ago, you know, so helping companies to see what that looks like in the future.
And now, Flip, if there's a business leader that's listening right now and they're feeling overwhelmed by the data, the digital transformation, the buzzwords, what's one of the first steps that they can take just to get them going in the right direction?
Yeah, well, obviously call me. I would love to have a discussion. It's very much like anything. You have to be informed. The difference between being informed and overwhelmed is very crucial these days. You know, you can't be an expert on AI, going through a few ChatGPT prompts and say, okay, now I know everything, and, you know, I'm going to lead my company in a new AI era. The things we know today, tomorrow is old news, you know, so you have to keep evolving, and that's where the strategy part comes in. As with anything in life, is having that North Star, knowing where you're going as a company. I think that's very important. And for leaders, that often feels a little bit overwhelming. It's like, okay, well, you know, I have to do this, and my day to day can get a little bit clumsy, you know, and that's where the use case for consultants still comes in. They're still useful to get into your company with have a fresh set of eyes on your company and your operations, and sort of guide you as to where's the ideal environment for my company to go to.
No, I think that's very true. I've also been in the consulting space, and they definitely do have a role. I think there are some bad apples in the consulting space that give everybody a bad name, but not all consultants are bad. And now you emphasize that strategy without execution is useless, and I 100% agree with you there. How do you ensure that your strategies get implemented and are not just a nice-to-have document, they get approved, but then they're ultimately shelved?
Yeah. 100%, John. We're all aware of this. You know, 70% of all strategies, you know, they're not executed. They just, you know, stay there in a file somewhere on someone's computer. So it is about being practical for me. It's not having this pie in the sky dream and selling it, you know, just, you know, billing more hours as a consulting company and doing copy and paste of what you've done for another client, because that's sort of works and the logical thing. And, you know, after charging X amount of millions of dollars, saying, you know, we're going to cut costs and increase profits, you know, that's not the cookie cutter doesn't work as a consultant. So, you know, if you want a strategy that's practical and implementable, you know, that's you have to work with a company to see what they are capable of doing with what they have. It's good to make a company to make them dream as to where they can go, but, you know, we have to stay practical and design strategies that's achievable for the type of company that we're working.
And now, Flip, definitely a bad strategy would be to put AI on top of bad architecture. And you told me previously that that's like putting a cherry on a cake. What do you actually mean by that?
Yeah, so John, as we all know, you can't build a house without a foundation. If we don't know what's going on, you know, within our company and why we're not getting the results for the AI that we want, you know, just implementing an AI automation tool to do reporting, for example, is not going to solve the problem. We have to look deeper. We have to see how data is generated and how our architecture is structured. The AI is a very good vanity tool, and executives like using it to put their company and to use it as a marketing effect to get some news out there and you know, have a little a report on LinkedIn and say, okay, well, our company is doing X, Y, and Z with AI, but actually you're just adding more complexity, you know, and somewhere there's an analyst that actually have to work in a day to day, and you know, are you making life for them easier or are you making it more complicated for them?
Yeah, and talking about AI, Flip, you told me that you're building an AI readiness assessment. What is that about? What are you hoping to achieve with that?
Yeah, it is, John. So we obviously get a lot of questions: is how can we use AI? You know, we want to speak to executives about data strategy, and you know, the first thing they say they're interested, but what can we do with AI in our company? AI has a big influence. AI, you know, we're seeing SaaS companies, you know, becoming zero value now because, you know, basically everyone can code anything that these days, you know. So it's a valid question. What we do find is that there's an easier solution than going through 6 months or 1 year consulting project to find, okay, well, you're not ready. you know, so we can save executives a lot of time by doing a sort of a checklist, running through key stakeholders, you know, having these discussions with them, and instead of doing a long project, you know, we can have a standardized a template that companies go through and assess the readiness. And I think that is already having a lot of impact. You know, we're doing it actually with a few Lacquer network members, you know, to see if we can have, distributed simultaneously and have a bigger outreach and obviously give everyone a fair chance to have access to reports, and gives us a better lay of the land as to where companies are in terms of AI readiness.
That's very interesting, Flip. And I think that just helps the business owner get some sort of comfort that you're on their side. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on and they can easily be overwhelmed. So if you can just give them a bit of a journey that they can go on with you and say, look, this is how we're going to take you from zero to hero in terms of AI, in terms of your data, then it can really be a good fit for any company out there. Now, if the company is saying that they're data-driven and they're ready to really jump into data, are there any good signals that you're looking out for or touch points that will give you comfort that these guys are ready?
Yeah, so the big part would be the data capturing. So do you actually know what data do you have in your company? You know, that would be a big part. And the other one would be, what is your objectives? What are your goals? Why do you want to become a data or an AI-driven company? We want to automate a lot of the day-to-day tasks. But you have to think about, you know, if you automate a lot of these tasks, doesn't mean, you know, people are going to get bored in certain things. Is it going to make some jobs, redundant? You know, that's not necessarily the place that we want to get to. You know, we want to be clever and we want to be logical about what you do. So it's definitely having those objectives. Why do we want to be AI driven? Why do we want to be data driven? So, you know, if you start understanding, if you can understand that why, and if that's a clear answer, it's the first step. And then the second step would be, how do we capture data? What data are we able to capture? Where do we store it? How can we use it? You know, easy questions to answer. And I bet you 95% of companies can't answer those questions today.
No, that's very interesting, Flip. And when you're going through this process with the company, are you also building in allowance for training and change management and things like that? Because, I mean, people have been doing things for many years the same way, and now you come in, change everything, change how they capture data, change how they process data. How are you handling that?
Yeah, so the people part for me is very important. And obviously, you know, we touched a little bit on that, and the fact that I was a rugby player and I've been part of these high performance environments, I can see the difference, and I'm a living example of it. The difference, you know, the same person can make when he's in the right or she's in the right environment. You know, so if it's an environment that motivates people to perform, that motivates people to become data custodians, you know, that's an environment where your company becomes performant, you know. So there's a lot of allowance in that. And the fact that I'm independent and a smaller consulting company, you know, I can touch on several different aspects. I don't just have to push presentations through, and because, you know, that's what my boss said I have to do. We definitely have a big look at the people, at the people aspect, at how data is captured, at you know, and to give you simple user examples, you know, we've worked with a client here in France where the data in the field was still manually written on papers, you know, and they sort of struggle to understand, but why, you know, it is on a gas pipeline, they can't automate, you know, incidents. So, you know, that's just a simple practical thing that you have to go, but you have to drill and you have to be in the field and you have to speak to the people, you know, working down the line on the data. So there's a big allowance. There's a big allowance for the people. And then, as you say, the change management, how do we work with the new technology? How do we educate people? How do we train people to, you know, work with new technology that's going to appear on my computer tomorrow? You know, I don't want to be left out in the field and they still need to hit their KPIs eventually when you leave.
No, that's very interesting, Flip. And I'm glad you're looking at the people, because ultimately people buy from people and people are the ones working with the data and everything like that. Flip, at the Right Place podcast, we believe your right place is at the intersection of your roles, relationships, and environments. So I just want to focus on that a little bit right now. You said last month on LinkedIn, I didn't just get back on track, I rebuilt the damn track. I really love that intention. Where are you today in terms of your comeback journey? And tell me how that started.
Yeah, John, it's a very interesting, you know, as you know, it started as a fitness journey, but I think it's become a lot more than just a fitness journey. You know, you can speak to any ex-sports man or woman, you know, the change after professional sport is quite severe. It's quite tough to find your place and what motivates you. And then on top of that, you know, I had a life got a little bit in the way, you know, I started neglecting my own health, in a sense that, you know, training sort of got less and less as work got more. And, you know, I delayed, you know, going to training because, you know, I have two young kids at home. So, you know, you have to wake up early to go train, but then, you know, don't want to leave, your wife alone with the kids. And there's all these excuses that came and, you know, I ended up at 152 kilograms, which is quite a lot of weight to carry around. And then, you know, the ripple effect of that is, you know, you get a little bit more grumpy, you're a little bit more tired, the end of the day is complicated, your performance start dropping, you know, there's like mental health issues that start surfacing, you know, you don't have all the belief that you have in yourself. And I've actually had a very good friend that helped me get back on track, in Stefan Weyers, who's been with me all my life, you know. And, you know, just step by step, you know, as we spoke earlier on the incremental values, you know, just day by day, do little bit things that you start amazing yourself, you know. That, you know, quick example, yesterday I had sort of a bad training day. But I still did 10 kilometers, you know, of running, which, you know, it just goes above my head. You know, when I started out, I could barely walk 1 kilometer, you know, without being out of breath. So, it is about getting someone that backs you again, that guides you on the right way. And then, you know, you start amazing yourself and you start looking back and everyone knows, you know, when you start doing well in sport, you're a little bit more motivational and, you know, you're a bigger pleasure to be around for other people as well.
That's wonderful, Flip. It's a wonderful testament just to the power of these incremental steps that you're taking and replacing bad habits with good habits and almost just getting out of your own way and just focusing on doing the right thing.
Exactly.
And Flip, I really look forward to seeing what you're going to do with it. I'm sure you got some fitness challenges up ahead of you. What's actually on your radar in terms of using this newfound fitness?
Yeah. So No, I can't get the right word. I've got the French in my head. I'm going for an Ironman at the end of August. So the half Ironman, 70.3, 2 kilometers of swimming, 90 kilometers of bike, 21 kilometers of running. No, I had to do so. You know, if I do something, let it be severe. Let me test myself against the best. And it's going far. It's going well so far. You know, the data is showing that, you know, I will be able to do it. It is quite a big challenge. It takes a lot of time, but it's, you know, if you put yourself to the extreme, you know, that's where you test yourself and the ripple effect on that, on business, on relationships is great at the moment. You know, it's the cycling part is actually extreme. It's such a good networking space. It's crazy. But yeah, and then, you know, use that as sort of the foundations of, you know, going into the future. You know, I want to stay sort of an athlete or fit person. You know, as I said, I've got two young boys and I need to run after them soon, you know, so they're all over the show. And keep fitness as a foundation for the rest of my life.
Excellent, Flip. Wish you all the best. Look forward to seeing the photos on LinkedIn really, really soon.
I will keep you guys informed. Yeah.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Now, Flip, the network of a Springbok must look quite interesting after time. I mean, you have your school friends that grew up with you before you became super famous in the Springbok and the Blue Bull. You've got the Worm in your street. You've got your dad's friends also coming from maybe the Springbok era. The players that you meet, the sponsors, the hangers-on, the takers, the general public. How do you maintain genuine relationships in this crazy space like that?
Yeah, so it's a very, very interesting discussion, Jordan. And I was listening to another podcast earlier while sitting on the bike, you know, because we have a lot of time on the bike where you can listen to podcasts and you know, maintaining these relationships is very, very, very important, you know, especially in the business context and you know, being able to still add value is the big question. You know, you go the day you stop being a professional rugby player, you know, it is true that, you know, some friends and some supporters drop off the bus just because, you know, you can't add that, you know, you add value if you're a superstar. You know, people can come watch you and support you and stuff like that, or you can give them tickets, etc. It is still is important to make effort and get in front of the people, get in front of their faces, you know, remind them, you know, what just keep that relationship going. You know, if we get into like a business development side of things, say, okay, well, now, you know, the tables have turned a little bit, you know, what can we do? How can we work together? You know, and that's the slogan of the Lacquer Network that I enjoy the most is, how can I help you? You know, sort of change that, you know, how do we get a project out of this to how can we help each other? Add value, you know. So it's a lot of work in maintaining that relationships. I'm not always the best, you know. When you're building a business, you sort of get into your own little hole and you start grinding and you know, in a digitalized age, you know, we keep forgetting that, you know, the just having a beer together or the warm handshake or having a golf or a walk together, how important it is. And, you know, I enjoyed your podcast the other day where you guys said, you know, how can you add value when people are getting busy? And that there's some very good insights in there as well. You know, just a little message of support where, you know, a friend is very busy or you know, just a check-in every now and then, sort of make it a list to check in, you know, on people. That's very important, yes.
No, excellent, Flip. I love that answer. And thanks for the support of our podcast as well. I think it's really important to know that these things go through different seasons. And you had a season as a professional rugby player. And you've developed as a person, as a human being. You've gone through life's ups and downs. Now you're in the corporate space, but you're still a value to add, and you still can achieve a lot. You still can add value to people, but also that you've matured over time. You've seen people just want you for your money or your fame or for or whatever the case may be. And if people treat you like that, then you've got to believe in, hey, man, this guy's showing me a bad side of things. And I don't need this in my life. So I can just ignore them and focus on building these genuine relationships, like you said.
Exactly.
You're activating within the LACA network. Now, yeah. Flip, you've reached the top of rugby success, played with amazing players, were coached by legendary coaches. Is there a coaching session or a coaching slam down by one of the coaches that still sticks in your mind that really just like shook you as a player, but like you hold on to and like remember what that coach said in that situation? And that still has stayed with you to this day?
There's obviously a lot of things coming to mind, and there's a lot of things that we, you know, coaches are different in all their ways, and certain things that you learn from certain coaches, you know, back in Rassie Rasmus is very, you know, it's well known. You know, he's famous for being so good these days. You know, and people can see what he does, and you know, he's made the documentaries, and he's got his own podcast even now, and he speaks about leadership. You know, but back in the day when we started, and he's very practical about coaching. You know, there's no BS about what's going on and what's happening, and that helps. Doesn't always work in a corporate environment. You have to be a little bit more politically correct, especially when you come to Europe. But you know, that's something I took from him. You know, and back in the day when we started, he was the first guy to swing out 3-hour video sessions to go through. You know, I had Heineke Meyer as a Springbok coach, who's a very visual guy, tells like 3 stories per training, you know, before a game going out, you know, so there's a book to write about all the stories that he had, but you know, a lot of very good examples that you can use, you know, but, you know, and we had characters like Vaini Strydom as our team manager, at the Bulls, you know, who could always summarize a situation and help you out of it, you know. And we had one particular time, we were top of the world, but we were sponsored by, we had like a pretty poor sponsor at the Bulls, you know, and when we got our kit, you could see everyone's a little bit disappointed, you know, so these things look like they came from a street corner somewhere. And he just said, you know, and excuse the language, but he said, just said, we all know this is shit, but everyone doesn't need to say that it's shit, you know, and that sort of summarizes what's going on in a company. You know, sometimes when you go down a, you know, you're on a downward trend, you know, if it's easy to jump on that and everyone say, okay, well, it's going bad, it's going bad, it's going bad. But, you know, if you don't come up with a solution, or you just, you know, you're not the North Star, you have to tell people, you know, we're actually here for a real job, you know, so it's a lot of things that relate. As you said, had a lot of great coaches.
Excellent, Flip. That's very interesting. Now, Flip, for every Springbok that had a successful career after sport, there are still a few that fade into the background. They don't necessarily get endorsements or a corporate job. They are not on TV. Have you still got contact with a lot of your Springbok friends, your Blue Bulls friend, but like the more like the non-famous ones, the guys we don't see on Super Sport every week or playing cricket and paddle and golf days and that?
Yeah, no. You make friends for life, and we still are very good friends. And there's a lot of old rugby players building very, very good businesses, in the shadows, as you say. You know, a lot of the forwards, they're used to that. You know, they're used to working in the shadows and not taking the shine. So yeah, we still have good community, and luckily these days, you know, we have WhatsApp groups all over the show. And to be part of and see what people are doing, teams we play with and people that were opposition that you became friends after with. So we check in. It's important to check in and see that everyone is doing well and fine.
Now, Flip, if you allow me, I've got one more rugby question. In my research, I saw a few years back, you gave your perfect 15 rugby team to SA Rugby Mag. Obviously, Dan Carter, Richie McCaw, Victor Matfield, Brian Abana, they all made your list there. And then for the 8th man, you said Dwayne Vermeulen, and you said better to have with you in a team than to be playing against him. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Dwayne, I was lucky enough, you know, I played with him at the Cheetahs already when he was a very young guy, and just raw talent. You know, very, very good guy and very hard worker. And, you know, it was amazing to see what he became later in his career. We didn't play together as much for the Springboks, you know, because I think he was sort of still growing his beard, you know, back then. And, you know, and he had to wait for his turn because there were other great players, you know, guys like Piers Peace, et cetera, too, that played above him, you know. So, yeah, Dwayne is such a great player and such a good guy. Definitely a very good person and leader to have in the team. And, you know, that's why it makes perfect sense why Rossi chose him to stay in the mix, especially guide the young guys in the Springboks setup. I think it's a great guy to have on the team, not just as a physical, very Thor-like player, but also as a mentor and a leader.
No, like a flip. That's great to hear. Something you might not know about me is I've gotten to know Dwayne over the last couple of years because his son and my son play in the same rugby team here in Durban.
Yeah.
And I must tell you, like father, like son, you don't want to be playing against Dwayne. You don't want to be playing against your son. They're gonna take you out.
yeah, it's not fair.
They're gonna talk you out forwards, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I like them, man. Flip. Lastly, my son is 12. He's playing excellent rugby. Got so many great friends. Every lighty's dream is to play for the Springboks. But obviously, we've got so much depth, so much talent, so many schools playing rugby nowadays. What would your advice be to a 12-year-old boy about just playing rugby right now at this age that they're in?
Yeah, first would be just enjoy it. You know, that's why if you don't enjoy it now, you will never be able to do it later on. And it's more advice for the parents than it is for the young boys. You know, because you know, the rugby itself teaches you all the lessons you need to know. It teaches you humility and it teaches you hard work and it teaches you resilience and to get back up from the floor when you get smacked, you know, and, you know, so, but more for the parents, and I'm stealing this from Australian fast bowler Michael Kasparovic that said, you know, and it goes about the chat in the car after a rugby game. That feedback that you give your kids. And I think it's very important, you know, and it's not always to, you know, when you run, do this, or when you tackle, do this. But, you know, I think parents, especially South Africa, they forget to ask the children that you enjoy it. And that for me is the big, especially at that age, 12, 13, 14, where you're sort of discovering what is life. To go, you know, you have to go out there and you have to be able to run with a smile on the field, you know, because that's what it is. John, you know, when where we are now, you know, you often sometimes when you play golf, you get to enjoy with buddies and have a smile. But, you know, the life out there, you don't get to run around with friends all the time for free. So, you know, just young kids, just enjoy it. Just, you know, running around, especially now in Cape Town in the mud, you know, rolling around. It's the best time of your life. So yeah, just enjoy it.
Love that answer, Flip. Thanks so much, man. Appreciate that. Now, Flip, like me, you were a founding member of the Laka Network. Tell me about your experience so far and why you joined originally.
Yeah. I love the Laka Network, and, you know, I believe in South Africa, you know, that's the best thing. And I believe that wherever we are in the world, we make a difference. It was about, you know, getting out of your own network and getting to know more people and people having influences around the world. And so far, well, John, like this discussion as we met over the Laka Network, and, you know, it's just been incredible. You know, South Africans are Laka people. I think it is definitely a networking environment with a different type of spice. It is not mundane. It's alive and well, and there's a lot of deals going on back and forth, you know, and everyone you meet, you know, even if it's just for a random discussion and there's not really business, you just feel better after such a discussion, you know. So, as I said earlier, I believe in the in the Lacquer Network's mantra of how can I help you? You know, that is South Africans. We're always there. We always want to help otherwise and other people and reach a hand out to, you know, and that's something that I want to continue. And, you know, and as the Lacquer Network, I can see it growing and I can see it being more stable and getting more chapters all around the world. You know, I want to be part of it and I want to, you know, proudly bear the flag for South Africa, in a corporate sense, after the rugby.
Excellent, Flip. That's excellent to hear and very grateful to have connected with like-minded people like you, who's had this amazing career and also still sees the value in being a South African, championing what South Africans are about and the lack of gears that we have and connecting the dots and just helping each other. Because, I mean, that's what really makes South Africans different. We can talk nonsense about rugby. We can catch up over a beer or at the braai. And just, we've got this unbelievable advantage in being able to connect with each other. So if we can support each other in any way, open doors of opportunity, encourage one another, then we can really build amazing businesses wherever they are in the world. And I think the Lacquer Network can really be at the forefront of that. It's just helping each other. Because, I mean, we know what it's like to be South Africa. So why not? Let's just help each other be better South Africans and fly the flag
100%.
High.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more, John. It's such a, I think there's already great businesses that we see in the Lacquer Network and we see the results of when anyone has a little bit of a need or a want, how quickly people react and be able to put in contact. I recently had one of the boost sessions, you know, and that's such a live and you feel so great after you feel like you can conquer the world, you know. So, I love South Africans and I love the Lacquer Network.
Excellent, Flip. Excellent. Now, Flip, we always end off our podcast by asking the same question to all of our guests. And that is, Flip, in 2025, what does being in your right place feel like?
Yeah, very good question, you know. And my motto for 2025 is the ripple effect. As the Lacquer Network, I feel in my right place when I'm able to help other people. You know, so whether it be kids or whether it be in the corporate environment or, you know, whether it starts at home, you know, and what means being able to help other people is that you need to be in a good situation, you know, so, I'm looking after myself and by looking after myself, I can look after my neighbor and I can look after the community, you know, so, that definitely is my right place and it's not a perfect science yet, but yeah, we're definitely working towards that and helping other people and creating that ripple effect of just being good. You know, the world needs more good people.
No, definitely, Flip, I agree with you. I think the ripple effect is something that, I mean, we all know about it and we should actually know that like one good deed leads to another. And sometimes we're in a situation where we want to choose vengeance or we want to choose to go and sulk in the corner, but what's the next right thing that I can do? What's the next good thing I can do? Just to change things around. And that might lead to something amazing happening further down the line or right around the corner. So I really believe we collect these moments of doing the right thing, putting other people first, being helpful, being useful. And all of this builds up. I mean, the universe has an amazing way of rewarding you somewhere down the line. And it might just be someone just sees a different side to you and like, oh man, I just thought you were a rugby player and you had no time for me, but you gave the person the time of day or you helped them with a small problem. And maybe they end up helping you one day as well. So it really works both ways. And it's a wonderful way to live your life, I think.
Yeah, 100% agree with that, John. You know, and I heard this somewhere and I don't know where it is, but you know, South Africa, definitely South Africa and the world needs to move. You know, we sort of forgot our neighbor, you know, we moved away from knowing the guy that lives next to you and knowing being able to help them, you know, and that's where in a time of need, you know, you definitely need to know your neighbor and treat your neighbor. And that's exactly what you said. I love that. I'm going to use what's the next good thing I can do.
100% Flip, this has been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate your time and talking to you today. If people want to connect with you to learn more about you, what you do, what Level 6 Consulting can offer them, what's the best place to do that?
Yeah, you can reach out. I'm pretty active on all the social medias, you know, LinkedIn, Instagram, even Twitter every now and then, or X as they call it. Reach out or, you know, join the Lacquer Network. I'm on there, and we can have a chat. very much looking forward to what comes out of this. It was great speaking to you, John.
Thank you so much, Flip. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Flip Funimava, the legend himself. Please connect with Flip on social media. Send him a DM on LinkedIn. Please remember to like, follow, and subscribe to the Right Place podcast. Wherever you're listening to this, please share this with your rugby friends, the Blue Bulls, the Cheetahs, and don't forget your Griffin friends as well. Share the podcast with them. Thank you so much, Flip. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, John. Good luck to everyone out there. Good luck to the Springboks this weekend. I hope you have a great season.
Awesome. Thank you, Flip. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next time at the Right Place. Cheers.